This week I have an exciting episode brought to you by the University of Sydney's Brain and Mind Centre. Over the next 2 weeks, actually, I get to interview four incredibly passionate young individuals who come from lived experience and are involved in the Brain and Mind Centre's Youth Lived Experience Working Group. Now, this working group sits across the streams of research which the Brain and Mind Centre conducts, and we've heard some of those streams and projects that they are producing at the moment. And they help advise, co-drive, and co-participate in the research so that it is intrinsic to what young people need and want out of healthcare services and the information that goes into understanding what's needed. So this week I have the brilliant Andrew and Rachel, who are giving us a rundown on the history of lived experience in mental health and the role that advocacy has grown to play. This is going right back to ancient Egypt, which personally I found was really interesting, all the way through, you know, Nazi Germany and the experimentation and, you know, the benefits that that has brought us to modern medicine, but also the negativity and the horrific practices it also had with it, right through to today and the role that they play on the Lived Experience Working Group at the Brain and Mind Centre. Thank you, Andrew and Rachel, for joining me today. It is such a pleasure to have you in the Brain and Mind Centre's Lived Experience Working Group. You both add so much character and so much nuance to the group with both your lived experience and also your career and professional knowledge. It's also just such a pleasure to know and learn more about both of you as a selfish sort of aside sort of point.
Thank you, Sam.
Because you both are really incredible, and it's really inspiring to be meeting young people like yourselves standing in union. So thank you so much for both elements being on here and being able to sort of be in your presence monthly.
Oh, thank you, Sam. It's an honour to be working with you as well.
Today we wanted to talk about one of the key things that we wanted to talk about when sort of looking at this mini-series with the Lived Experience Working Group was what advocacy looks like within mental health care and the mental health sector from a lived experience perspective. And in the next episode, I'm chatting with two other wonderful members, Annie and Dakota, who are bringing us up on what we're doing today and sort of what it means today, particularly in a research setting. So we're going right back to the beginning with you, Rachel and Andrew, which is super exciting. And from the notes and the off-air chats we've had, it actually shocks me how far it goes back. And it's really exciting. So, I mean, where does it go back to? I can see it on the side of my screen, but Andrew or Rachel, where does it sort of begin?
Gosh, how much time do you have?
40 minutes.
I guess, like, I would personally start by even, like, you know, going back further than people might realize. I think that the way that mental health is talked about, and you can especially notice this when you know, read a book from, like, you know, the Middle Ages, pre-Renaissance era, even like during the Industrial Revolution, and just the way that mental health is discussed, or quote unquote lunacy is discussed, I would say that there are a lot of, I would say, damaging assumptions made about mental health that I think kind of echo and reflect the long history of mental health advocacy and how far things have progressed and how much further we may have to go. So I guess that's a good place to start. For example, how, you know, even as far back as like ancient Egypt, forced lobotomies were quite common. We know from archaeological evidence that, for example, lobotomies were conducted upon even in like that, in the ancient world. And that I would say, like, even up until the 18th century, a lot of these ideas that people have of people of lived experience and mental health being dangerous were really perpetuated up into, like, well into that point. So, like, I mean, Rachel, what do you think in terms of where to begin?
Well, yeah, definitely. I mean, it depends on how I suppose, the language that you're using, because it wasn't always discussed as mental health or as lunacy. Sometimes it's considered demonic possession or that sort of thing. And advocacy might have come in the form of a rebellion against the church or something like that. There are obviously, I think I would start at like the things that we can clearly point to, the historical evidence that we can clearly point to being like the alleged lunatics friend society. I can't remember exactly when that was. Was that the 18th century, which was in England, with some sort of former asylum patients getting together to try and madhouse patients trying to get together to improve the conditions in madhouses, the very inhumane conditions that they would very much describe as torturous in their writings. And from there, there were different individuals in different groups, predominantly from sort of more upper class society, where they might have slightly more sway instead of government or other areas, trying to advocate for improved conditions specifically in different asylums or services or places where people with mental illness might be held, including jails. Yeah, really talking about the conditions that they experienced, about sort of the way in which they were confined against their will indefinitely, even when they hadn't committed a crime, really. Although I suppose homelessness, flagrancy, that sort of thing was always a crime at that point. So
I would even draw attention to like the etymological origin of some words that we still use to this day. For example, the word lunacy is an allusion to, you know, the moon, because people genuinely believed back in the ye olden days that the cycles of the moon were what caused, you know, mental health issues. Another word that I like to bring up as a nexus for this discussion is bedlam. So bedlam is described is defined as a noun for like uproar and confusion, but what people don't know is that it's actually a name of a psychiatric hospital where in the 18th century. Yes, it is. And people, and it, the hospital famously charged it would charge an admission fee for non-psychiatric patients to go to the hospital and to basically look at the people who are confined there like the animals in a zoo. It's actually quite it's actually quite saddening to think about how even the language that we still use today is actually reflective of the, I would argue, stigmatizing historical assumptions we have about mental health.
Well, I mean, even the transition from using committed suicide to died by suicide, or
it's a crime. Remember, it was
you committed a sin and you committed an act of crime, like you said, against the church, and like you were saying earlier, Rachel, like some of these mental illnesses or episodes were considered a rebellion against the church, and so it's been a huge push to actually get that to change, you know, in everyday use. And it kind of still grinds on me when I hear it in a TV show or something where I'm like, surely you would know better than to use that. It is interesting from a language perspective, linguistics of how far we've come, but also how far we haven't come.
Yeah.
Like the language around that we use around mental health, mental illness has been seriously contentious for a really long time, and it's been a really important point of advocacy for a really long time. Simply changing the name from from patients, or a long time ago it was lunatics, but in the mid 20th century it was patients, simply changing that to just being people, as opposed to being cases, as opposed to being, you know, an issue to be solved, people in need of support. And the idea of the term consumer, which is what we predominantly use in the industry at the moment, came about because people were seeking more sort of choice and more agency in the healthcare that they received.
Yeah, I would agree with what Rachel just said, and I would also add that what's interesting is throughout history, whenever progress or change was made with regards to just how individuals with lived experience were treated by the psychiatric system, well, a lot of those changes were really propagated by people with lived experience, with sometimes by their carers, but in particular by people who were either in these facilities or had just left these facilities. For example, I mentioned Bedlam, right? Bedlam is famously, I believe, the first quote-unquote madhouse in the UK. There's a great documentary about it from BBC History Revealed. And what they talked about is that in 1814, when an inspection was made, the inspectors noted that one can hardly imagine a human being in a more degraded and brutalized condition than that in which I found this female, and that it had the appearance of a dog kennel. This is up until 1814. And immediately right after that, during the Age of Enlightenment, I would argue, is when this idea of moral treatment came to play, which was this idea that, hey, maybe the quote-unquote insane are not wild animals who have like lost their reason. Maybe they're not people who are possessed by the devil. Maybe we should start treating them less like dogs and more like people. And I think what's interesting, right, is that the moral treatment movement itself had a lot of issues with regards to the treatment, the ethical treatment of people within these facilities. And, you know, the next movement that came after that was the mental hygiene movement. And it doesn't escape me that the person who helped bring attention to the need for treating mental health as a hygiene issue, or rather a public health issue, was a man called Clifford Beers, who was actually admitted there. And it doesn't escape me that this was a straight, cisgender, white, affluent male who was Ivy League educated, who was like, let me bring attention to what's happening inside these facilities. And then, you know, like, I think, like, you know, Rachel and I, we were having some really good discussions about our personal feelings at the mental hygiene movement and the issues of that. I think that was like, I think what's really evident historically speaking is that there's a lot of overcorrections that happen. There are a lot of, I think, you know, people trying to really find that sweet spot and often overstepping it, or either not shooting quite far enough. And I think that'd be, I think, a really interesting discussion to have in terms of how mental health advocates and those of lived experience helped, I guess, push forward these progresses and helped, you know, work on this work in progress.
So we know, I guess, I would argue that it's somewhat general knowledge because it appears in pop culture so much, you know, with maybe it's the kind of pop culture I tune into with things like American Horror Story and things like that, which isn't everyone's taste, I must admit. But we do know that there is, a large progression of our knowledge within mental illness and mental health disorders comes from Germany or German clinician scientists, researchers. What was the sort of the big sort of part around the 30s, 40s, that sort of post-World War era with medicalization?
We're just going to have to cut straight to the chase and talk about, yes, and be blunt about this. In 1920, there was an essay, which is quite a famous essay, especially amongst anyone who studied this time period, called Permitting the Destruction of Life Unworthy of Life. Don't make me say the German phrase because my German is terrible. But essentially, it was an essay written, I believe, in a 1920 book by two professors, in which there was this argument that certain individuals could be targeted and should be targeted by the state to be quote-unquote euthanized. And these were members of the state who were considered to be empty shells of human beings. They actually specifically included the psychiatrically ill in this category, but also designated people with intellectual disabilities, people with acquired brain injuries. And it was this concept that most historians agree led to the eugenics mindset that then expanded to include anti-Semitic and racist ideologies around racial purity, as well as homophobic ideologies, as in homophobic ideas around, for example, depopulating the queer community. And unfortunately, following this idea of which lives are quote-unquote worthy and unworthy in the 30s and then, you know, extremely tragically in the 40s, there was medicalization of social programs. But more importantly, I would say there was systematic euthanasia within not only German mental institutions. There were also heinous, truly heinous experiments conducted upon not only people of Romani descent, the LGBTQ community, people who were from the psychiatric institutions, but also the disability community. And, you know, those legacies do reside within psychiatry. For example, up until what, the DSM-5, Asperger's syndrome was literally listed in the DSM.
And, as a mental disorder.
Yes, instead of calling it autism spectrum disorder. And what people don't realize is Dr. Hans Asperger was an Austrian psychiatrist who has been now well established as having very controversial connections with the Nazi regime.
Just a casual Monday evening chat, right?
Yeah. Can I just say one thing, a final thing about that, because I do think it's important to note, is that so when Hitler came into power in the 1930s, he did one of the most controversial things he did is that he signed into action a law of, it was called the law of coercive sterilization. And this was historians call
even the name is first step.
Yeah, but specifically, what's noted is that this law was it essentially meant that all German citizens who belonged to the following categories had to undergo compulsory sterilization or euthanasia, and it was specifically the categories included were people with schizophrenia, people with hereditary conditions such as chromosomal conditions, and finally those who were called social deviants, which included homosexuals. And that eugenics ideology is as most it was then what really opened the gates to like further eugenics, including campaigns against people of Jewish descent, Romani descent, Polish people, etc. But I really did want to stress that law and this idea of compulsory sterilization, this idea of removing people with lived experience, especially such as those with schizophrenia, and considering them a threat to society to the point where, we're going to make that decision for you. We're going to order compulsory sterilization, and making that decision for someone as opposed to that decision being made by the person themselves. That's why it's so heinous. Autonomy. And I really wanted to stress that, because I would argue that that mindset of psychiatrists and lawmakers and policymakers making decisions for others and individuals, especially people from vulnerable marginalized communities, persisted into the 1950s with the creation of the DSM-1, for example. Like, it's not a coincidence that these mindsets that divest autonomy continued into the 50s and the 60s, whereby...
Which is just wild, right? Like, it was...
It is.
We had so much... You know, sort of, there were so many things breaking ground and coming through, and obviously a lot of things were still, a lot of minority groups were still very much under oppression. But I think it's because, you know, I almost place it within this context, right, of to here, now, today. And it is just something that just seems so foreign and so backward. When it comes to the lack of autonomy or the autonomy of an individual being taken away, there was that kind of beginning of that, wasn't there, Rachel, around the 60s, like you're sort of saying, Andrew, when the DSM sort of that part with David Cooper, I think it was.
Yeah, and it's not just that. I mean, we can talk about Nazi ideology until the cows come home, but it's really mixed in with different Western ideologies as well.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you mentioned before, Clifford Beer's part of the mental hygiene movement was about either not admitting entry or deporting foreigners with mental illness from America. And it all goes back to this idea of like trying to, I suppose, reduce the population of people with mental illness within the broader population, but more specifically, like trying to protect the community from mental illness, as opposed to trying to help people with mental illness be a part of the community. That has been the idea for generations, for centuries, has been about separating people with mental illness from the community.
It's 100%. It's about like protecting the community from us rather than helping us to then help the community. But it's honestly so frustrating to me that like sometimes people are so quick, especially a lot of psychiatrists and psychologists are quick to dismiss what happened in the 30s and 40s as like a blip in history of like, oh no, that's a series of, you know, it's like as my favorite, you know, it's a Lemony Snicket series of unfortunate events. It's like,
we admit we did some shady things, but like, let's look at today. Let's look at today.
Exactly. When in reality, the Nazis only amplified what was already like implicit in a lot of their systems and ideologies. They didn't create something necessarily new. Instead, what they did was they were a product of their time and were allowed to become the monsters that they then became. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah. It's super hard because, well, it's not super hard. It's like the silver lining, and even to use that term, I feel sick. But the things that the advancement that it did do for mental health treatment and interventions and things like that sort of did project the clinical side forward, which, you know, in turn does support us, but it is the lack of autonomy, the lack of respect, the lack of actually seeing the individuals as people. And like you were saying before, referring to them as animals, and in the Bedlam hospital, treating them like it was a zoo. It's just insane. So, like, pardon the pun.
Well, I just want to bring up the 70s, though, because I feel like the 70s were a really great time, at least in terms of, like, activists happening. Like, it was, like, for example, like, it was in the 70s that the gay rights movement, as well as the civil rights movement and the women's rights movements, these were all, like, I think, really protesting, you know what I mean? They were coming in with protests. And, you know, I think it's important to note that gay rights activists did protest the American Psychiatric Association in 1970. Mm-hmm. And why did they do that? Because they were like, oh, your DSM lists homosexuality as a mental illness. Yeah. How about maybe let's not pathologize and medicalize a whole group of people from a minoritized background just because you, Mr. Straight White Doctor, don't understand it.
Yeah. Well, again, it comes back to the point of, you know, this is kind of, at that point, homosexuality was believed to be like a deviant behavior, and it was about protecting the community from that deviant behavior. And psychiatry was just a really, useful vehicle for doing that.
Yeah, it was a good scape dog, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I think it's important to note that, like, it was what? Not like the DSM-3 in 1980 didn't rectify, I think, the homophobic overtones of how I was discussing the lived experience of those from the LGBTQ community. And then they had to literally release a revision in 1987 stating that actually removing the diagnosis of ego dystonic homosexuality.
Yeah.
And it is really a sexual disorder. Yeah, mental illness. It is, and it's quite insulting because it's essentially assuming that someone's sexuality is this deviant facet
disordered
that must either be
thinking
exactly
that can be changed. Yeah.
Not only that, but it should be changed or erased or not be propagated onto the broader community. And it's essentially, you know, it brings about this idea of what if someone is gay and they are happy and they are perfectly fine of who they are and they are not a threat to society in any way. Is it a place of a psychiatrist or a psychologist to then say, oh yeah, I think this is a problem? No, I would argue that it's discriminatory, and it often comes from a place of ignorance, which is why the DSM was revised and they removed it.
And I think that this was the conversation that advocates and activists were trying to have around all mental illnesses, not just homosexuality, saying like, okay, we experience reality differently. If it's not actually damaging to us or our community or anything like that, what's the desperate need for you to change us? What's so wrong with us that we have to be medicated or separated from the community? Like, if we are living healthy, happy lives, why can't you just let us live?
I mean, and who has the right to judge someone else's life and to then divest them of their autonomy and their right to self-determination? I would argue that this idea, right, of forced sterilization, of involuntary treatment, of involuntary detainment, these are essentially echoes of how people in the past were treated like animals and how we were treating them lesser than rather than
it's just a new skin.
People. Exactly.
You know,
it's
dressed up.
Yeah. And then, you know, even I would say in the 90s, this was still an issue. For example, where, you know, in the 90s, we started to really notice the autistic self-advocacy movement, right? And it was only in the 90s and 2000s that, like, even like, you know, I as an autistic person can say this, like a lot of autistic people were getting tired of frankly, the idea, right, that our neurological differences were things that should be fixed and things that should be altered and things that should be problematized and removed. Mm. And in reality, like this idea of, let's say, neurodiversity or this idea of accepting individual differences, whether it's someone with, say, like schizophrenia or someone with ADHD or an autistic person, is that do we really need to try and quote unquote fix someone to fit a neurotypical norm? Kind of like how in the 70s and 60s, people are trying to quote unquote fix queer people, or how, you know, everyone's favorite problematic daddy, Freud, literally wrote a book called The Etiology of Hysteria, where he thought that women's emotions literally came from a wandering uterus. Like, it's, oh, come on.
And how is that? I guess I see a lot of parallels in, you know, some of the things that we're going through today within, not just within mental health, but the wider sort of society element. Particularly around I think we're probably more conscious that normal, the word is not
quote unquote normal.
Yeah, is actually something that none of us really know. But there still is that movement that it's like, well, no, the normal is the neurotypical, the normal is this, the normal is this.
Yeah.
Where does advocacy sit from that perspective, having been informed by these consistent battles literally right back to ancient Egyptian times?
Well, my question is, like, even that word normal, like, I personally don't use it in my vocabulary, and it's something that, you know, in therapy I've consciously tried to remove from my vocabulary because it's a bit judgmental. Like, another one is healthy. I try to say helpful instead of healthy. Instead of saying normal, I often think like normative, maybe typical, neurotypical, because I think the word normal essentially implies that there is like this baseline standard that we all should aspire to be, and where, and what advocates will do, and what we, and what advocates have done historically, is point out that what one community's definition of normal or and another community's definition of deviant or divergent, it may not necessarily be another culture or another community's definition of normal or deviant, and that is that instead we should not be making policy decisions based on a quote-unquote idea of a normal, but instead try to make decisions with people rather than to people and at people. I mean, that's why in disability rights, for example, a common, you know, clarion call is like, nothing about us without us. And that's something that's used in the anti-psychiatry movement and the MAD movement. It was also used in the trans liberation movement. It's like, stop making policies about us as people without consulting us, without working with us, without actually
having one of us there.
Which has been a huge thing
for which has been a huge thing for the Brain and Mind Center, right? In actually being able to establish this lived experience working group and being able to, you know, we're still in infancy stages and parts of the group is still very much being conceived, but being able to work with our wider team in the youth mental health and technology team of the Brain and Mind Center is huge, to be able to actually be doing that. But yeah, Rachel, what is your opinion on, I guess, the advocacy of today, what it feels like, and where you've seen the how it's been informed by this vast history, from horrible situations to, for lack of a better term, after just discussing it, normalizing, you know, having mental ill health episodes or things like that?
Interestingly, I would say that there are massive parts of the history that are being forgotten as part of the kind of modern advocacy movements. Andrew mentioned that, you know, a lot of psychiatrists aren't that engaged with the history. They don't understand that a lot of the medical history does come from kind of Nazi era experiments that were done without people's consent or that sort of thing. And I would like to see more advocates pushing for example, more respect and honor in those sorts of things. I would like to see acknowledgements at the start of psychiatric conferences that say, most of the medical knowledge that we have wouldn't have been realized without the harm and death of hundreds of thousands of people with mental illness.
Yeah.
I'm not saying we necessarily need to consider it, you know, a genocide or anything to that degree. I'm not qualified to answer that question, but that sort of stuff needs to be more recognized in the advocacy. And quite specifically, the stuff that happened in the 70s when you were talking about lived experience engagement in current things like policy and program planning and research, as we're doing at the Brain and Mind Center. Advocacy during the 60s and 70s was really split between these two groups of psychiatric survivor and mental health consumer. Psychiatric survivors really found themselves speaking up against sort of coercive practices of psychiatry and saying, you know, they've been traumatized in asylums and that sort of thing. Whereas mental health consumers were much more willing to say healthcare has really helped us and we really just want to help improve healthcare as much as we can. And at the time, there was a really tough situation where psychiatric survivors were really booted out of the conversation effectively for being considered disruptive or unhelpful or something like that in favor of consumers, which is why, for example, we use the term consumers today in our work, in our field.
So they were more consumers back then, were more palatable and sort of excluded, like you were saying, those psychiatric
politically radical people were very much booted out of the conversation, and it's created a culture where consumer is the only way to be engaged in the field. And I think advocacy should be getting more and more involved in the political end of it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I agree. To me, I kind of analogize it to, from my own lived experience as a queer person, kind of the trends we see in the LGBTQ community, and that up until marriage equality, there was a lot of, I think, understanding, at least among queer people, that like that our existence is political because of historically how we were treated and how we have to fight for our rights to be treated as equals, to marry whom you choose, whom you love. But then after we got marriage equality, a lot of queer people, especially those who were not trans, people who are not queer people of color, a lot of them say that, oh, like we would like to now remove ourselves from these discussions around political discourse and around fighting for our trans brothers and sisters and trans, you know, our non-binary pals. And I think to analogize it to and compare it to what I've noticed in Mad Pride, for example, and a lot of discussions around mental health, a lot of people, I think, they are a bit skeptical and scared and cautious and wary of being advertently political, because a lot of the times the tallest poppy is the one that's cut first, or the tallest nail is the one that's hammered down the most. And I get it. It takes courage to speak out. But I think, unfortunately, kind of similarly to the LGBTQ discussion, being someone who has lived experience, I think it means, at least from my perspective, being willing to speak up and speak truth to power, and to be willing to speak up about, you know, things that we are noticing in our systems and in our institutions and in our communities. Like, for example, yes, we've come far and we no longer treat people like animals, but, you know, it's still legal under the Mental Health Act to, you know, involuntarily imprison someone, and that you need two psychiatrists to be released. It is still, you know, forced sterilization may not be happening at the same rates that it occurred in the 30s and the 40s, but there were laws and cases such as Marion's case, in which a woman who with an intellectual disability was not given the right to decide what she does with her own body, and that essentially the decisions of her caregivers who wanted her sterilized would trump that of her own individual choices. And restrictive practices are still occurring against, you know, the autistic community, against quote unquote anyone with behaviors of concern, towards people who have schizophrenia, for example. These things are still happening, and I think it's not, to me, being political is about these things is not a matter of personal or ideological difference. For me, it's a matter of being a part of history, right? And I don't want to wake up one day and realize that I was on the wrong side of history. I don't think Rachel does either. And I think...
Oh, definitely not.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't think history repeats itself, but I do believe it rhymes. And
that's clever.
Yeah, and I think it's incumbent upon us to at least recognize historical trends and to speak out about them.
Yeah, no, I there was a few things that really hit there. And I think one of the things that I thought about, I've been binging a medical show similar to Grey's Anatomy but called Chicago Med, and 7 seasons, really good if you want to get into it. But one of the things, like you're saying, you know, losing the autonomy over her own body in Marion's case, that's quite standard when it comes to physical health or general medical health. If the individual is no longer either able to make rational decisions or is, you know, out to it, you know, in a coma situation or things like that. And so it's left to either the loved one or the state to take directive over the individual's body, their life, the choices. Like there was one episode about an amputee and they had to cut the leg off, and the husband and the wife had to make that decision, and the husband who had the leg removed, you know, there was hatred and was seeing red. And it was just really interesting because you see those as physical health things and you sort of see them in a different light to exactly what is being rhymed over the years, to use your terming, Andrew, when it comes to taking someone's rights away and their autonomy away and their decision making. What are your views on this, Rachel? And I guess specifically, where does it sit today in those things like Andrew was sort of alluding to?
I don't think we can talk about the loss of autonomy and the loss of rights without also bringing up the recent Britney case, obviously.
Yeah.
She was in a position where she couldn't legally speak out against her guardian, sort of publicly and legally speak out against that. And she didn't have the right to hire her own lawyer to defend her. She had her rights to, she had her reproductive freedoms taken away from her and all those sorts of things. I don't know exactly the specifics of the case, but by the sounds of it, it also she had the right. It also sounds like she didn't have the right to quit her job and stop performing if she chose to. She spoke about sort of being coerced into performing and saying, if you don't perform, we're going to up your meds, this, that, and the other. And I don't want to go into the specifics of the case because I don't know them, but I understand advocates not wanting to get political for fear of that sort of repercussion. Quite specifically, I want to point to something that Judy Chamberlain said, which is like, mental health has to be political because we are in a position, unlike any other, where the issues are not specifically medical, they are legal. For anyone who doesn't think that this sort of stuff also happens in Australia, more than 18,000 people a year sit in front of mental health review tribunals in Australia, and almost always they sit without a lawyer, and almost always the courts rule in favour of the psychiatrist. Yeah. I'm talking over 95% of the time, and these are people younger than 18 as well.
And for those who think that it's not political, like, you know, Chamberlain was saying, it's so interesting. I think we see that a lot throughout society. To sort of reference another celebrity recently, it was Jennifer Lawrence who was saying, it was about, you know, politics in America, but saying, I can't fuck with people who aren't political anymore. You live in the United States of America, you have to be political. It's too dire. Politics are killing people. And I mean, that sort of has that same sentiment, that if you aren't being, you know, if advocates and sort of quote unquote radical thinkers or radicalized individuals aren't taking part in politics, then politics isn't necessarily just politicians or policy or things like that. It is, like you were just noting, Rachel, the court cases and tribunals. Politics is... We know politics is down to work in workplaces. We know politics is in, you know, a psychiatrist linking with another psychologist that they prefer or they like to work with, that might actually not be the best fit for the individual they're referring them to.
Well, I honestly believe that like the fact that our systems and our institutions still to this day conflate disability and criminality. They conflate essentially mental illness and what that entails with a form of impairment, with a form of deviance. It's essentially a form of institutionalized ableism. It is a form of institutionalized, I would even argue, sexism, in that we know from studies that, for example, borderline personality disorder is overdiagnosed in women, and that autism spectrum disorder and ADHD are underdiagnosed in women, and specifically that a lot of these misdiagnoses occur around gendered assumptions that people have about each of those conditions, and around, for example, you know, that like that, you know, this idea of like hysteria, right? The fact that histrionic personality disorder is still the name of a condition in a DSM is like, if that is not a artifact and a signifier that, oh yes, sexism is still a part of institutions, that I don't know what is. And I think when it comes to being political or not political, I think often that is a privilege. And to be able to make that choice is a privilege that some people have. For people from minoritized backgrounds, and for people from who are autistic, disabled people, people who have lived experience of institutions, for example, it's not a choice. It is, we have to be political because essentially for us, self-advocacy and systemic advocacy are one and the same coin. And until laws are reformed and until systems are reformed, change will not happen. We have to be the change we want to see in the world. And I think it's not a choice, at least for me. I wish that for many people, they are able to make that choice of being political, not political, because I do think it speaks to a level of privilege. And I think until we reach that day, I think we can be more comfortable with having uncomfortable discussions.
Mm. At the moment, almost all of the discussions where it sits around advocacy comes to let's increase awareness of mental illness and let's reduce stigma and let's increase healthcare options. We're not talking politically, publicly, anywhere near enough about the legal discrimination that still goes on. And mental health advocacy should also be connected to advocacy around housing, advocacy around welfare, all of these other things that affect a person's life. To believe that you can improve someone's mental health, you know, situation while they're homeless or while they're living in poverty is, that's madness to me. that's an insane belief. Mm. Yeah. So I believe that all these things need to be connected.
It's a biopsychosocial model of health, I think, personally. This idea that, if someone is fleeing domestic violence or if someone is dealing with homelessness, right, that talking about their problems and raising awareness about them is it should be the primary way of alleviating their disability, not, you know, giving them safety, shelter, food.
Empowering them.
The Maslow's of, you know, hierarchy of needs. But no, sure, let's talk about it further.
Yeah. So in that spirit, if someone wanted to get involved in changing, being political, being radical even, where would one go?
NAMI is a good place to start, or into their history. I know it's American, but I do think that the role that they played in just the deinstitutionalization movement is pivotal. And I just think there's a lot of great reading there in terms of advocacy services in Australia. As a, you know, autistic person, it would be remiss of me not to bring up, for example, People with Disabilities Australia. I think a lot of the times people don't realize that you can have a psychosocial disability. If your lived experience of mental ill health affects your life to the extent that at least one of your quote-unquote domains in life, whether it's socialization, learning or whatnot, is impacted, that is a psychosocial disability. You are entitled to payments under the NDIS. You're entitled to, for example, like specialist disability services, to victim services, for example. My heart really hurts. It truly feels heavy when I hear about stories from those with psychosocial disabilities, specifically those people with treatment-resistant depression, for example, who could have been eligible for the NDIS, who didn't apply for it due to believing that, you know, that quote-unquote disability is something that doesn't fit their paradigm, and I'm a strong believer of destigmatizing that word. So that's what I tell people, is that if they believe that their mental, their lived experience and mental ill health impacts their life to the degree that, you know, at least two domains in their life are impacted, such as like learning, mobility, social, for example.
Yeah.
Daily living is another one that you know, there's something like the PW with that. And I think, you know, destigmatizing the word disability, which is often treated as so dirty, I think is just why I'm bringing up that organization.
Rachel, what would be one place that you would suggest if someone wanted to sort of start getting involved, to go to, whether it's for more information or whether it's to create action now?
The places that come to mind are the state peak organizations that represent people with mental illness. For New South Wales, that would be
Being. Yep.
Mm. Yeah.
And there's also the National Consumer and Carer Forum, which is exactly as it sounds. It's a place where consumers come together nationally to discuss the issues and try to put those forward. Definitely the best places for information. And if you have the opportunity to put your hand up, either get involved in their sort of roundtable discussions or their surveys and give your opinions and give your feedback, that would be one of the best places to do that.
Well, thank you both so much for joining me. And again, thank you so much for being a part of the Brain and Mind Centre's young people that sort of help, like you were saying, Andrew, advise and sort of being able to co-produce research with you guys is just, it's immensely heartwarming, and it's encouraging, and to sort of sit here with you and this afternoon / evening and hear about this rich history, and not rich in, you know, it's exciting and it's wonderful and it's invigorating, but aggravating and impassioned and rich in the sense of it. There are just so many stories of people who have been overlooked for a struggle of theirs or a challenge of theirs or something that they were told should be able to change, and it's not something that should change either. Thank you guys.
Thank you so much for having us.